KRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. President Rouhani says Iran will return to its nuclear commitments once sanctions are lifted, as repeatedly stressed by the country's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The UN Special Rapporteur involved in the probe into the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi says she received a death threat from a top Saudi official last year. And also in our headlines, South Korea and the U.S. say North Korea has test-fired two short-range missiles, the first such move under the Biden administration. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has pledged a full return to the 2015 nuclear deal once all sanctions against the country are lifted.
If the other party, which is all the P5 plus one member states, decide to implement all of their commitments and lift the sanctions, as our leader stressed on several occasions, and it becomes clear to us that they are serious in this, we will also return to all our commitments under the nuclear deal.
Rouhani said despite the 3 years of injustice imposed on Tehran, Iran is ready to fully return to the nuclear agreement without claiming for any loss or damage at the moment. He noted that the remarks made by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei were very clear and left the other side no excuse on the issue. Iran started to scale down its commitments under the accord a year after the U.S. unilaterally pulled back from the landmark agreement in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Tehran. And Iran rejects a resolution by the United Nations Human Rights Council against Tehran, saying it's based on a selective and biased viewpoint. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said the European-backed resolution follows political aims and is confrontational. He said the Council reports have been issued regardless of Iran's humanitarian situation caused by U.S. sanctions. He said the sanctions have made difficulties in accessing medical equipment and medicine. Khatibzadeh said the countries which themselves are violators of other nations' rights are not in a position to claim these rights. Khatibzadeh said these countries should condemn the U.S. at the first place for the economic war it has imposed on Iran. The United Nations Special Rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Agnes Callamard said she was alerted by her colleagues that in January 2020, a senior Saudi official had twice threatened to have her taken care of. She said her colleagues perceived the message as a death threat. Callamard was the first official to publicly investigate and publish a detailed report into the 2018 murder of Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June 2019, concluding that there was credible evidence the Saudi crown prince and other officials were liable for the killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Yemeni parties and political activists have held a gathering in the capital Sana'a to mark the sixth anniversary of the Saudi-led aggression on their country. A number of party representatives and activists addressed the event, dubbed 6 years of resistance. The speaker slammed Saudi Arabia's ongoing military campaign and demanded an end to the invasion. One activist said, "Innocent people in Yemen are being killed while the world only looks on." He said, "Yemeni forces will keep protecting the nation and its honor against invaders." Another speaker said the Saudi aggression is tantamount to a war against humanity. The Arab Kingdom and some of its allies launched a war against Yemen in March 2015. The campaign has left tens of thousands dead and millions displaced.
Saudi Arabia has tabled what it calls a comprehensive peace initiative to end the war it waged on Yemen 6 years ago. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud said talks to end the war should be held between Ansarullah and the Riyadh-backed forces of former Yemeni president Abdel Rabbo Mansour Hadi.
We announced the kingdom's initiative to end the Yemeni crisis and reach a comprehensive solution. The initiative includes a United Nations-sponsored ceasefire. The kingdom calls on the Yemeni government and the Houthis to accept the initiative.
The initiative also proposes the reopening of Sana'a Airport, but Ansar Allah is skeptical. It insists the talks between Yemenis will only materialize if Saudi Arabia stops its interference, noting that Riyadh itself is part of the problem. The movement says Saudis should end the blockade on all key entry points into Yemen.
If the humanitarian steps are taken, as well as the reopening of Sana'a Airport, the unconditional reopening of Hodeidah Port, then this indicates that there is a serious desire to have a dialogue on the military and political operations. As for the initiatives only, these are not serious.
Ansar Allah's chief negotiator in the UN brokered talks, Mohammed Abdel Salam, earlier said the Saudi proposed initiative offers nothing new. He said Riyadh is using Yemeni's humanitarian rights as a means of pressure by maintaining the blockade on the country, which he said is unacceptable. That points to what Ansar Allah has always said about the Saudi proposed peace initiatives. The movement says they are stunts to secure Riyadh's own interests. Saudi-led forces have, time and again, breached UN-brokered ceasefires, with Ansar Allah by even conducting airstrikes on the so-called neutral zone. The latest such attack was just days ago when Saudi warplanes hit a grains depot in Salaf port, in violation of a 2018 deal that designates the port a neutral zone. Saudi's acts of aggression and blockade have drawn retaliatory attacks from the Yemeni army and Ansar Allah. On Tuesday, Yemeni forces carried out an airstrike on Abha International Airport in southern Saudi Arabia. It came a few days after a drone attack that targeted a Saudi Aramco oil facility near the capital Riyadh. Ansar Allah also targeted Riyadh with a ballistic missile nearly a month ago. Riyadh and its critical infrastructure coming under attack has dramatically upped the ante for Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war they stage on their neighboring country. Riyadh appears to be searching for a face-saving way out without having to offer any concession. But that is a non-starter for Yemeni forces, who have gradually managed to shift the momentum in the war that Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed on them.
Israeli warplanes have conducted air raids on several targets in north and southwest of the Gaza Strip. Positions belonging to Palestinian resistance groups have been targeted, causing damage to some residential areas. Earlier, we were joined by our Gaza correspondent, Asher Shannon, for more on the latest Israeli attack there.
The Israeli regime claims that these airstrikes were in retaliation for a rocket that was fired Tuesday evening towards the Israeli regime, while the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was making some sort of election campaigning in the south of occupied Palestine. Israeli attacks have definitely increased over the past 6 months, especially following the warming up of relations between Israel and some Arab countries in the Persian Gulf region. And many here believe that the signing of agreements between the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Israel have encouraged Israel to carry out attacks against the Palestinians and further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. These airstrikes also another example of Israel violation of the rights of the Palestinians, and also can be used by Palestinians in their efforts to condemn Israeli war crimes with the ICC.
Exit polls from Israel's fourth elections in 2 years suggest another political deadlock, as no party is expected to win an outright majority. Israeli media have projected between 30 and 32 seats for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. According to the exit polls, his party can fall short of a secured majority even if his opponent, Naftali Bennett's Yamina party, agrees to join a coalition. This is while Netanyahu called the election a great achievement for Likud and the right wing. He said Israel should not drag itself to another election. Over the past 2 years, none of the Israeli blocs have managed to secure the required 61 parliamentary seats for forming a cabinet. North Korea has test fired two short-range missiles at the weekend. That's what neighboring South Korea and the United States say. South Korea's military says two cruise missiles were fired off the North's west coast on Sunday. U.S. officials have downplayed the missile firing, saying they are not covered by U.N. Security Council resolutions that ban tests. The launches mark North Korea's first weapons test since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. Reacting to the news, Biden has said he does not consider the firing as provocation. Biden has said his administration is open to dialogue with North Korea about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but according to U.S. officials, Pyongyang has not responded to Washington's behind-the-scenes diplomatic push for talks since mid-February. Jennifer Chang says North Korea's missile test firing seems to be a response to recent remarks by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken against Pyongyang.
South Korea and the U.S. are downplaying the importance of the tests in public, but privately, they are probably quite concerned. When U.S. Secretary of State Blinken came here to Seoul recently with the new U.S. Defense Secretary Austin, he condemned North Korea in many ways, and he attacked North Korea's policies, and he also, after that, in Alaska, attacked verbally Chinese policies, and China is North Korea's main military ally. So the North did not take kindly to this type of hardline approach. And right now, it looks as though the Biden administration is going to continue the previous Trump administration's hawkish policies toward North Korea. And so the North has not completely given up on nuclear negotiations with the U.S. yet, but it is getting more and more concerned about the situation. It does not look like the Biden administration is going to adopt the step-by-step approach North Korea wants. The Vice Foreign Minister Choe Son-hee on Thursday, she was calling for an equal footing between Washington and Pyongyang, that they have to be equals in order to engage in nuclear negotiations.
Asian shares extend losses and hit a two-week low as coronavirus lockdowns drag on in many countries and the fear of another COVID wave haunts investors. MSCI's broadest index of Asia-Pacific shares outside of Japan was off 1% after falling 0.5% the day before. Japan's Nikkei plunged 1.8%, while South Korea's KOSPI fell 0.5%. Shares in China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taipei were in the red as well. Markets have been affected by a coronavirus surge that has resulted in further lockdowns across the world. The coronavirus pandemic keeps spreading across the world despite vaccination campaigns and restrictions in a majority of virus-hit countries. India has reported 275 more deaths and over 47,000 new infections. The new cases are the highest since November, pushing its total caseload to 11.7 million. The country has recorded the most number of COVID cases after the U.S. and Brazil. The disease is also taking its toll on Europe, with Bulgaria reporting nearly 5,000 new cases, its highest daily tally on record. The Balkan nation has logged over 31,000 infections and more than 12,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic. Ukraine has also reported a new daily high of 342 deaths. It has registered to over 1.5 million infections and more than 30,000 deaths so far. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has survived a no-confidence vote in Parliament. The vote came after a parliamentary committee investigating a sexual harassment scandal involving Sturgeon's predecessor, Alex Salmond, found that it had been misled by testimony from the First Minister. Saipuda's reports from London.
This was the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, last week when excerpts of the Parliamentary Committee report came out.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee. This leak from the committee, very partisan leak, tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report.
That final report is out today and accuses her of misleading Parliament by unknowingly giving an inaccurate account of her dealings with her mentor Alex Salmond in 2018.
What it is really a parliamentary game. I think at the beginning of this, they really hoped they were going to get Nicola Sturgeon. And if they could get Nicola Sturgeon, that would drive into support both for the Scottish National Party and for a further independence referendum.
But the findings of the committee's report contradict those of an inquiry carried out by prominent lawyer James Hamilton, the man Sturgeon herself asked to investigate her actions on what she knew and when. Whether she violated the rules by not recording her meetings with Salmond on the complaints against him, whether she acted inappropriately by resisting Salmond's call for her to stop the sexual harassment investigation, and whether her government should have conceded the case against Salmond earlier to save public money after he successfully challenged in court the Scottish government's handling of his case and was awarded £500,000. Hamilton's verdict, published a day earlier, not guilty on all four counts. After she won a vote of no confidence in the Scottish Parliament today, Sturgeon and her supporters say they want to draw the line under the Salmond controversy and move on. Her critics disagree. They allege the inquiry didn't look at further potential breaches of the ministerial code and that Sturgeon's government badly let down women at the heart of it all.
Both the Conservatives and the Labour MPs who are on this committee are still sticking to this agenda of trying to force Nicola Sturgeon out in order to damage the SNP.
The question on the minds of many now is what impact the Salmond saga will have on Nicola Sturgeon's Scottish National Party's chances of winning May's parliamentary elections and her plans to hold a second referendum on independence from the rest of the UK. Saeed Puriza, London.
Australia's worst flood in decades has claimed its first fatality in the hardest hit state of New South Wales. The body of a man was found in a car trapped in floodwaters in the city of Sydney. Authorities issued a new evacuation order for the area. Hundreds of military personnel are set to be deployed to the affected areas. The torrential downpour has so far submerged houses and swept away cars and livestock in many parts of Australia. More than 40,000 people have been ordered to flee their homes, and 10 million people have been affected by the floods.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Mitsubishi Corporation, its Japanese engineering affiliate, Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Scott Foster, an analyst with Lightstream Research, Tokyo, entitled Japan Incorporation Driving Towards the Hydrogen Energy Future. The article was published by Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. When Warren Buffett's investment company, Berkshire Hathaway, announced last August that it had acquired more than 5% of the five largest Japanese general trading companies, including Mitsubishi Corporation, Itochu, Mitsui & Co., Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corporation, most failed to notice that Buffett was buying into coal-fired power projects. Within 3 months, a group of institutional investors led by Nordi Asset Management of Finland sent a letter to Mitsubishi Corporation requesting that it abandon its Vang Ang 2 coal-fired power plant project in Vietnam. Friends of the Earth, Greta Thunberg, and Japanese environmentalists piled on, but to no avail. However, in February, Mitsubishi Corporation announced its withdrawal from the Vinh Thanh 3 coal-fired power plant project, also in Vietnam, and said that Vang Ang 2 would be its last such project. Both Itochu and Mitsui & Co. have also announced plans to exit thermal coal. Marubeni and Sumitomo Corp. plan to do so except in cases when no other source of power is available and where the most advanced emission reduction technologies are used. So, what will they do instead? These are large companies with annual turnover ranging from $48 billion to $146 billion before and presumably after the COVID-19 pandemic, operating in a wide range of businesses from resources and energy to infrastructure, industry, IT, and finance. They have no shortage of projects, and they're all involved in hydrogen energy. For example, Mitsubishi Corp., its Japanese engineering affiliate Chiyoda, and five local companies are working on the development of a sustainable hydrogen economy in Singapore using Chiyoda hydrogen storage and transportation technology. Itochu plans to build one of the world's largest liquid hydrogen plants in Japan with Air Liquide to supply fuel cell vehicles. Air Liquide already operates hydrogen fueling stations in Japan. Mitsui & Co. has entered into an agreement with Hiringa Energy to pursue commercial hydrogen energy projects in New Zealand. It has also invested $25 million in First Element Fuel, the largest developer and operator of hydrogen stations in California. Marubeni is working with Siemens and Master to develop hydrogen and other alternative energy technologies in Abu Dhabi. Sumitomo Corp. and Japanese engineering company JGC are planning to build a facility in Australia that would produce hydrogen using solar-powered electrolysis. These and many other Japanese companies are also getting involved in hydrogen energy through consortia and industry associations. Recently, the Hydrogen Energy Supply Chain, HECS, pilot project in Victoria, Australia, announced that the world's first coal-to-hydrogen production process had begun operations. The HESC project is being implemented by a consortium, including from Japan, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, J-Power, Gas Distributor, Iwatani, Marubeni, and Sumitomo Corp., supported by the Victorian, Australian, and Japanese governments. Last October, the Japan Hydrogen Association was established by Mitsui & Co., Iwatani, Kawasaki Heavy Industries, Japanese Oil and Energy Company, ENEOS, Coop Steel, Mitsui Financial Group, Kansai Electric Power, and Toshiba. It aims to form international alliances and develop global hydrogen supply chains. In December, those companies were joined by Toyota and shipping company K-Line. In addition, K-Line, Iwatani, Kansai Electric Power, Nomura Shipbuilding, the Development Bank of Japan, and Tokyo University of Marine Science and Technology have formed a group to promote hydrogen fuel cell-powered ships. Marubeni is also leading the COP Kansai Hydrogen Utilization Council, which aims to develop a regional hydrogen supply chain in west-central Japan. The council includes many of the companies listed above, plus power plant equipment maker Mitsubishi Power, general contractor Obayashi, and Shell Japan. The Japanese are keen on industry associations, which often overlap. It sounds bureaucratic, but ensures a degree of coordination that would be hard to achieve otherwise, as well as logistical and financial support for worldwide operations. Iwatani recently announced plans to produce hydrogen with Stanwell Corporations in Queensland, Australia, and to build 7 new hydrogen fueling stations in California with Toyota. With interest high in Toyota's latest developments in hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles, it's worth pointing out that Honda and Nissan also make hydrogen FCEVs. Toyota began financing the construction of hydrogen fueling stations for passenger cars and other vehicles in California in 2014. Honda quickly followed suit. Toyota, Honda, and Nissan have been supporting the development of hydrogen station infrastructure in Japan since 2015. ENEOS now plans to install hydrogen pumps at its gas stations, a first for Japan and one that points toward a nationwide build-out. ENEOS operates some 13,000 service stations from Hokkaido to Okinawa. Available data show that there are now some 135 hydrogen fueling stations in Japan, 150 plus in Europe, more than half of them in Germany, about 80 in North America, more than half of them in California, and more than 70 in China. The list of hydrogen power applications continues to grow. Buses powered by Toyota hydrogen fuel cells are being introduced in Japan and Portugal. East Japan Railway Company, Hitachi, and Toyota are working on train engines powered by hydrogen fuel cells and storage batteries, and construction equipment maker Komatsu plans to develop hydrogen-powered mining trucks. There are questions about hydrogen energy, most of them having to do with its relatively high cost, how it can be transported efficiently and safely, and the potentially negative environmental consequences of hydrogen production. All of these problems are currently the subject of research and feasibility studies. Hydrogen fuel is currently several times more expensive than gasoline, but the price should come down as the volume produced and sold goes up, which will happen as Japan moves from 135 hydrogen stations now to several thousands in ENEOS network alone. Transport is made economical by liquefaction and compression. Scott Foster wrote, as with gasoline, safety is a matter of pipe, tank, and fueling system engineering. At one trade show I attended in the United States, an industry representative explained that this company's hydrogen fuel tank could withstand an attack by 50 caliber machine gun. Hidden environmental costs are a concern with most, if not all, alternatives to fossil fuels. In the case of hydrogen, the issues getting the most attention are the source of energy for electrolysis and potential carbon emissions from the coal to hydrogen production process. The former is easily monitored. The latter will either be dealt with efficiently or the technology will fail economically as well as politically. As for competition, KMPG's Global Automotive Executive Survey of 2017 found that 78% of 1,000 senior auto executives thought that hydrogen FCEVs would eventually outperform battery-powered EVs. Elon Musk is not one of them, but Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are pursuing both battery and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. Some industry observers believe that the cost of new technology and infrastructure will prove to be too high, but both government support and the long, but incomplete list of companies mentioned in this article suggests otherwise. In any case, Warren Buffett investments have done well so far. As of March 12, the share prices of Japan's five biggest trading companies were up 45% to 99% from their 52-week lows.
Debate. Saudi Arabia has proposed a peace plan to end the years-long war it started on Yemen. The move follows an escalation in drone and missile attacks by the Yemeni army on crucial Saudi infrastructure, including airports, oil facilities, and getting closer to the capital, Riyadh. The Yemenis don't seem eager to accept the proposal, as they have set their own conditions for a peace initiative. In this edition of The Debate, we will shed light on the different aspects of the Saudi proposal and the reason why the Yemenis are not gasping for it.
Saudi Arabia has tabled what it calls a comprehensive peace initiative to end the war it waged on Yemen 6 years ago. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud said talks to end the war should be held between Ansarullah and the Riyadh-backed forces of former Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi.
We announced the kingdom's initiative to end the Yemeni crisis and reach a comprehensive solution. The initiative includes a United Nations-sponsored ceasefire. The kingdom calls on the Yemeni government and the Houthis to accept the initiative.
The initiative also proposes the reopening of Sana'a Airport, but Ansarullah is skeptical. It insists the talks between Yemenis will only materialize if Saudi Arabia stops its interference, noting that Riyadh itself is part of the problem. The movement says Saudis should end the blockade on all key entry points into Yemen.
If the humanitarian steps are taken, as well as the reopening of Sana'a Airport, the unconditional reopening of Hodeidah Port, then this indicates that there is a serious desire to have a dialogue on the military and political operations. As for the initiatives only, these are not serious.
Ansar Allah's chief negotiator in the UN brokered talks, Mohammed Abdus Salam, earlier said the Saudi proposed initiative offers nothing new. He said Riyadh is using Yemeni's humanitarian rights as a means of pressure by maintaining the blockade on the country, which he said is unacceptable. That points to what Ansar Allah has always said about the Saudi proposed peace initiatives. The movement says they are stunts to secure Riyadh's own interests. Saudi-led forces have, time and again, breached UN-brokered ceasefires, with Ansar Allah by even conducting airstrikes on the so-called neutral zone. The latest such attack was just days ago when Saudi warplanes hit a grains depot in Salaf Port, in violation of a 2018 deal that designates the port a neutral zone. Saudi's acts of aggression and blockade have drawn retaliatory attacks from the Yemeni army and Ansar Allah. On Tuesday, Yemeni forces carried out an airstrike on Abha International Airport in southern Saudi Arabia. It came a few days after a drone attack that targeted a Saudi Aramco oil facility near the capital Riyadh. Ansar Allah also targeted Riyadh with a ballistic missile nearly a month ago. Riyadh and its critical infrastructure coming under attack has dramatically upped the ante for Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war they stage on their neighboring country. Riyadh appears to be searching for a face-saving way out without having to offer any concession. But that is a non-starter for Yemeni forces, who have gradually managed to shift the momentum in the war that Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed on them.
To discuss that further, we're joined by lawyer and human rights activist Kim Sharif out of London, and also director of IGA Ali Al-Ahmad out of Washington, D.C. Thank you very much to both of you. Let's begin with Kim Sharif from London. Now, the Saudi proposal comes at a time of increasing attacks on its crucial infrastructure, and while U.S. President Joe Biden has called for an end to the Saudi-led aggression, although no concrete measures have been taken so far in that regard, how genuine is the Saudi peace plan?
Good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join you in this program. That's absolutely not serious enough, because it's clearly flavored with malafide ideas, bad intention, because if they really wanted to stop the aggression on Yemen, there's nothing to stop them from stopping it. All they have to do is wave the white flag. But what they're doing instead is they're just tiptoeing around the issue of continuing to pretend that this is a civil war and that Saudi Arabia is a bona fide peace broker, when it cannot be that. Saudi Arabia is a leading member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been pounding Yemen for the past 6 years to smithereen, quite frequently, in fact almost always, targeting civilian places. As recently as this week, they have targeted a hemp farm in Al Amran area. They've targeted another factory. So Saudi Arabia is not a bona fide peace broker for it to be making a proposal. That's one thing. The second, Saudi Arabia is an aggressing party. It is an enemy. It is a party that is guilty of the serious crime of aggression against the state of Yemen. And this proposal is yet another attempt at misleading the world into thinking that it is now trying to sort it out. What it doesn't want to admit is the fact that it has been defeated spectacularly. After 6 years of its world support and Western support, I'm talking about here, world support, Western support, with arms, politics, diplomacy, every known force to mankind today under the sun has been used against the Yemen in order to occupy the Yemen and control its destiny. But they failed miserably, despite the limited resources of the people of Yemen, and its government in Sana'a have managed not only to defend themselves, to defend the country against this aggression, beautifully, but also they've now turned the table the other way insofar as they are attacking the heart of the Saudi infrastructure, as your reporter has quite rightly pointed out. So they have been defeated. That's what they are trying to avoid having to admit. And the more they continue their aggression, the more the Yemen will be producing its own weapons, the more the Yemen will be fully entitled to defend itself. An eye for an eye is the only law that applies here, because international rules of law have been disregarded, disrespected, and not complied with by Saudi-led coalition and its Western backers. So the Yemenis are left with nothing but to defend themselves. And yes, they are entitled to do what they are doing, and they must continue. Their legendary fortitude of 6 years under the world's worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe is simply amazing. And we have much respect for the leaders of the Yemeni government in Sana'a, and we hope them all the best.
Well, thank you very much, Kim Sharif. Let's move on to Ali Al-Ahmad from Washington, D.C. Now, as Kim very correctly pointed out, and Ansarullah Movement has also mentioned, that the Saudi Arabia is actually part of the problem, not the solution. So do you believe that the Saudis are actually just using this as a strategy to buy time because they're exhausted by a war that they did not expect would last so long?
This appears, I agree with Kim, that this is not a serious offer, and it is not designed to end the war, even if the Yemeni side said, okay, go, everybody goes home and repair their car, as we say. This is part of an agreement between the Saudis and the Biden administration to give the appearance that Saudi Arabia wants peace, and the only people who are standing who want war are the Yemenis who are fighting the Saudi and their foreign backed bombing blitz of Yemen for 6 years. You saw how the British, the English-dominated British government came up with basically very nasty statement calling on the Yemeni and using pejorative language against the Yemeni people to call on them to accept the Saudi initiative, which was created or they came up with it in consultation with Washington and London, the two major foreign powers that are backing this bombing campaign for 6 years. So this is part of a larger plan to do something else. In the UN Security Council, they are trying to cook up another resolution that will absolve all those people who have committed war crimes in Yemen, be from Washington or London, Riyadh or Abu Dhabi, in Sudan, in Morocco, and all those, and Jordan, and all those who bombed Yemen and destroyed and killed thousands. They are trying to create another UN Security Council, and in preparation for that, they are coming up with this initiative so to isolate the Yemeni forces that are fighting against this invasion. And so this is not a serious offer, and it's just the first step of a campaign, of a political campaign to isolate and to delegitimize the coming power in Yemen. That is those Yemenis who are fighting against the invasion.
Well, thank you very much. Now back to Kim. Well, of course, you have both mentioned that this is not a serious offer, but we do know that since Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war on Yemen back in 2015, several peace initiatives have failed. Why did these initiatives fail to be acceptable to the Ansarullah movement?
Well, they never came forward with any realistic resolution for the problem, insofar as we have said time and again from the beginning of this scenario, this is an act of aggression by Saudi-led coalition backed by the US and the UK and France, no less. This is not a civil war. That's one thing that really needs to be clearly borne in mind, simply because all the parties on the ground that are fighting with Sana'a government are allied to Saudi-led coalition, who get paid, the least paid of them gets $100,000 per annum. Saudi coalition, Saudi regime, from time to time, leaks the lists of the people who get paid by them to continue this war. And this leakage is often designed to entice others to join their ranks. But of course, they failed miserably because all they have is the same old Akab and Daesh and their political wing, Aslah Party, the Muslim Brotherhood of Yemen, with them in Riyadh hotels and Cairo hotels and Istanbul hotels. None other than that. So every attempt at trying to resolve the situation in Yemen wasn't a bona fide effort or attempt or desire to bring an end to the conflict, but it was just another sedative mechanism to make the world think that the international community are trying to resolve the situation, when the truth is there was no problem in Yemen, as was clearly declared by the then envoy to the UN, Mr. Jamal Ben Omar, in a recent long article in Newsweek, where he explained that all the parties in Yemen were in agreement under the peace and cooperation agreement after the national dialogue, and the Saudi-led coalition intervention came in on the 26th of March 2015 to frustrate that agreement. The Saudis and their backers didn't want peace in Yemen. They wanted to turn Yemen into another lawless, disintegrated, divided nation, as they did with Somalia previously. But luckily for Yemen, there was leadership consisting of variety of political parties, not just Ansar Allah, in association with Ansar Allah, in partnership with Ansar Allah. They managed to defend the country and unite the people. 80% of the people are under their leadership in Sana'a, IDPs, and they are protected. And the majority of the people of Yemen support this government. And so previous peace agreements couldn't work and wouldn't work simply because it was just another pack of lies, to be honest with you. Just another pack of lies, much like the lie about enforcing Resolution 2216. We all know Resolution 2216 was passed some 3 weeks after the start of the Saudi-led coalition aggression on Yemen. Kind of like you can never have a UN Security Council instrument that retrospectively authorizes use of force against any nation. And so Resolution 2216 doesn't actually authorize use of force. So, and in any event, it doesn't cover the whole of Yemen. It only affects UN-named people. Therefore, there can be no comprehensive peace in Yemen whilst the Saudi-led coalition continues its aggression on Yemen and continue to pretend to the world that this is a civil war, when it isn't a civil war. Those people who are referring to as the legitimate government is also another lie. They all know the former president had his term had ended with the end of the Gulf Initiative in February 2014. So to say it is a legitimate government is a blatant, disgraceful lie. These people are unethical. These people have no respect to the rule of law. These people have no respect to humanity. They've created the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe under a serious pack of lies, and they're continuing to do the same thing in the hope that perhaps suddenly the Yemenis will just give up on their integrity and their right to self-determination and their right to protect their sovereignty against the invasion of Saudi-led coalition. But that
Thank
is not going
much.
To happen. Yes, on. We're moving on.
Thank you very much, Kim. Let's go back to Ali Ala Ahmad. So, Ali Ala Ahmad, considering what she just said, what are the necessary steps for a political process in order to end the war? And is it even possible as long as the Saudis are involved?
The Saudis' involvement is designed to stop the Yemenis from making peace among themselves. The Saudi government and its foreign backers do not want to see the Yemenis own their own destiny. And we don't want to see Yemenis take advantage of their natural resources, their location, and to have independent policies. They want to see Yemen as basically the beggar and the poorer country that they wish it to see. They don't want to see it powerful and independent. Some Yemenis have sold that right for others, but most Yemeni people would want to see Yemen that is independent. That is part of the Yemeni culture, in fact, and enable that country to move forward on its own without hegemony from Saudi Arabia or other countries. The political solution has to be left to the Yemenis, and I wouldn't even want the UN to get involved, because we have seen one time after another that the United Nations is nothing but a tool in the hand of bigger states and powerful states to undermine the rights of people, especially in our region, and to deprive them from their basic rights and from poisoning their political future. Really, here it is upon the Yemenis, all of them, even those who are siding with the Saudi invasion, to think that this is time for them to come together and build their own country without foreign intervention from the Saudis or the Americans or the British. This is the time for the Yemenis to rise, and I hope they do it. And they can do it. They have proven that they can be. They can forgive each other. It's important, however, to realize that those countries, every country, every government, every regime that has helped bomb and kill Yemenis, must pay reparation for the Yemeni people. And I hope the Yemeni parties would start talking about reparation. If the Saudis must pay, the Emiratis, the Al Khalifas, the Sudanese, the Jordanians, the Americans, the British, the French, the Canadian, the Germans, the Spaniards, and the Italians, everyone who spent a single bullet and helped the Saudi and Emirati bomb Yemen, they must pay for the Yemeni people because we have millions of victims, and that's the least they can do beside admitting their mistake. You notice one thing here, that every all these foreign backers of Saudi and invasion of Yemen are not willing to disclose the extent of their involvement in the war, because they know themselves that they are committing a crime.
Thank you very much, Mr. Al-Ahmed, and also Ms. Kim Sharif. This question is addressed to both of you. The Saudi plan calls for depositing taxes and customs revenue from ships carrying oil to Hodeidah port into a joint account of the central bank, and a limited opening of Sana'a International Airport. This raises questions about what exactly the Saudis are looking for. And Mr. Ahmad, you did mention that the Saudis do not want the Yemenis to be able to exploit their own natural resources. Mr. Al-Ahmad, your comments, please.
I think it's very repugnant for Saudi Arabia to dictate to the Yemenis where they put and deposit their revenues and who should share what. This is not their place. They have no right. The Saudis will not accept if a Yemeni official says the Saudis must do this and do that in their own country. Yemen is independent and should remain independent from anybody, no matter who they are, be it the Saudis, the Americans, or the English, or whatever country you're talking about. The Yemeni future must belong to the hand of Yemenis, and they can work their problems themselves. They are not children, and they are not unable. The Yemeni people are very capable, and they can figure their problems themselves.
Thank you.
Very important to realize the Saudi regime has no love for the Yemeni people.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Kim Sharif out of London, we have less than 2 minutes. If you could please wrap up your thoughts regarding this final question.
I totally agree. Everything said by Mr. Al-Ahmed, he hit the nail on the head when he said that the Saudis are in no position to dictate to the people of Yemen. They are holding 14 ships carrying essential food, oil derivatives, and medicines unlawfully, arbitrarily, to starve the people of Yemen. And then they turn around and say, oh, we are prepared to do this. And they're closing the Sana'a airport unlawfully in breach of the sovereignty of the state of Yemen. And they turn and say they will limit the use. They're not in a position to dictate to Yemen, quite rightly. Out of Yemen's case, end of story. Yemen is not a back garden for you. The Saudi regime needs to recognize that. Otherwise, it is risking of its own collapse, because Yemenis will not give up their right to defend their sovereignty and to have the right to decide their destiny and their future. They will not give it up. 6 years on, we are producing our own weapons. 6 years on, we are now making them kneel down. And so this pathetic little show of attempts to try and resolve the matter and this dictation isn't going to work. We are free people, and we shall remain free people. And those who invaded us will pay very, very heavily for what they have done, here and hereafter, no doubt. And yes, we will be demanding compensation from every country that has been involved in the aggression on Yemen. And yes, we will not ask for the UN to be involved in this, not Britain or the US, because they are a party to the conflict. They are the ones who facilitated the worst man-made humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands are still dying per annum, mainly children, 50,000 of them per annum.
I'm very sorry, Ms. Kim Sharif. That's all the time that we have. Lawyer and human rights activist Kim Sharif out of London, and also Ali Al-Ahmad, director of IGA out of Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you for joining us on this edition of The Debate, and thanks to all of you for following us.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Chapter 7 is an interesting topic, talking about clothes and the etiquette of dressing. We're on the topic of zina in chapter 8 and how we are able to adorn ourselves or beautify ourselves. And zina is important in Islam. It's something that should be a fundamental characteristic in a mu'min. We've mentioned a lot of things before, but here we're going to be focusing on how important it is a person to